good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us a fascinating guest tonight. I'm sure you're going to enjoy Mr. Craig Wynn. Thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
Good evening, Dr. Stan.
Well, thank you so much for being with us again. Now, this is a completely different audience, so you don't have to worry about repeating some of the things you had said before. But Mr. Wynn set out some years ago to learn the truth about the Muslim faith, about the people who were responsible for what happened 9/11. So why don't I just let you go ahead and pick up the story and tell it from your point of view.
Well, certainly. I became interested in fundamental Islam just as America was being attacked. The morning of 9/11, I knew who was on those planes. I had thought it was more likely part of that 4,000-year-old family feud between the offspring of Ishmael and Isaac. But when I traveled overseas to meet with the terrorists and find out why in the world they would think it was a good thing to kill innocent people, and why they shouted out Allahu Akbar, Allah is great, while they were murdering innocent people, I found that that it had nothing to do with the old family feud, that there was a new doctrine available in the world, and that doctrine was corroding these men's minds.
Well, you know, it's of course fascinating. Why don't you tell our listeners how it was that you were able to actually go and to meet with these terrorists? Because most people never have that opportunity, and of course this took a great deal of personal courage on your part, and yet you set out intentionally to meet members of Al-Qaeda and these various terrorist movements, and to spend time with them to try to understand what was motivating them.
Well, I figured somebody had to do it. I mean, the reality is that 85% of the violence worldwide is a direct result of Islam, and I was convinced that we weren't getting the straight story from our media and from our politicians, and since they were killing us, it seemed like the only rational thing to do is to ask them why, and then based on what they said, to learn what it is that drives them. Most of the time, that when there is international terror, there is some doctrine, some belief system that causes people to sacrifice their lives, and that's why I went off and in search for them. Now, it isn't particularly difficult to arrange meetings with terrorists. It's not particularly wise either, I guess, in that most people who try to do so get killed. But they're eager to talk to the media, to use the media. They're experts at using the Western media, and the Western media has been a major accomplice of the Islamic terrorist movement around the world.
Well, let's just a little bit of your background. You've been a businessman, an entrepreneur. You've developed companies. What have you done before you took your trip over to Israel? Now, you've been very successful in the business world, haven't you?
Yeah, I've started three different companies, built three companies from nothing to $100 million, took two of them public. My last business was worth $3 billion when I resigned for it. That was only 3 years after I started it. So I've had quite a tour of the business world. My last experience in business was about 2 years ago when one of the founders of my last company and I sat down and decided that we would write a story about the corruption that we saw in corporate America, and published a book just a matter of months before the collapse of Enron and Global Crossing and Kmart and WorldCom. I called in the Company of Good and Evil about the villains that are lurking inside of corporate America, and why why businesses today are in great jeopardy.
All right, fine. Well, then, of course, with this sort of a background, a successful businessman, you were able to make contact somehow with various of the people working with Yasser Arafat. And let's just take it. You go to Israel. You've made contact with people within the Arafat, Yasser Arafat's administration, and they are going to arrange for you to meet with representatives not only of Al-Qaeda, but of Hamas and many of these other radical Islamic organizations. But you're going to have to meet with them on their terms in their location. So pick up the story from there.
Sure. In fact, while I did meet with Palestinian Authority ministers, the last thing they wanted was a Western journalist meeting directly with the terrorists. They introduced me to people who knew terrorists, and ultimately I negotiated a bargain between them and the Mossad to facilitate the meetings. And the reason that I went to Israel, particularly the West Bank, is that it is obvious that the ground zero for suicide bombers worldwide is the West Bank. The kind of activity that we saw on 9/11, where planes were turned into suicide bombs, is no different than what happens every week inside the West Bank in Israel. So ultimately, the Mossad brokered a deal, took me to the border, made me sign a series of papers that said what I was doing was foolish, that they would have no way of even tracking where I was, where I would be taken. They could not rescue me, and that it was likely that they would kill me in the process of conducting these interviews. In fact, the last words from the Mossad agent, who has become a really good friend, is, Mr. Wynn, if you lift the latch of this door and walk across that border, you're a dead man unless you're on God's mission.
And so you lifted the latch, you went across into the other area, and there was somebody there to meet you.
There was, kind of a James Bond series of signals. In fact, the whole story is actually told in the signature chapter of Tea with Terrorists. We're taken through a series of cars and back streets, ultimately to a bunker in a rock building. And in that bunker, well underground, there's one interrogation table, about eight chairs, and for the next 6 hours, terrorists were paraded one after another, sometimes in groups of two and three, to meet with me.
All right, fine. Now, of course, you're there. You have a couple of people with you as well. You're unarmed, though, no really means of defense.
I'm armed with a pen, which is mightier than a sword, perhaps, but not very effective for hostage negotiations, I don't think. I did have two other people with me, the co-author of Tea with Terrorists, Ken Power, who, after 10 days of screaming at me for this being the dumbest idea I ever had in my life, at the last minute, when I left the latch, stopped screaming at me and followed me. And Jerry Falwell's chief of staff, Duke Westover, a very good friend of mine, and expert in Israel, did the same thing. After 10 days of yelling and screaming that this was a crazy idea to go meet with a terrorist, he followed me in as well. So there were three of us.
All right, fine. So you're taken then, and you really have no idea where you are, where you're going. Did they blindfold you or what?
No, they didn't blindfold us. We had no way out. They had the only vehicles. You're going into an area where there are more than a million of them. All of them are armed. They loiter the streets. No one is working. You're in such overwhelming odds. As they drive down the street and they stop, you find children, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, walking in the streets, walking in front of the van, stopping the van, pulling out pistols, and tapping them on the window and pointing them at your head. I mean, it's such a bizarre world. It's almost beyond description what takes place in these areas.
All right, so eventually then they get you into a building, and is it some sort of a basement where you're taken? Or?
It's a basement, barred doors, only about a 5.5-foot ceiling, one interrogation table, concrete walls, concrete floor. Looks like the kind of spot that you wouldn't want to spend your vacation, I'll tell you. It was one light in the room dangled and broken from the ceiling. it was right out of the movies. If you tried to script the kind of place that you would expect to meet terrorists, this was it.
All right, and so then, of course, then who do you meet with first? You and your other two friends are there, and of course, you are, is there anybody there that can interpret for you? Or?
Yes, first of all, most of the terrorists speak English. It's the international language for communication, and without speaking English, it's difficult for them to, particularly as leaders within these organizations, to be able to manipulate the media the way that they are so dependent upon doing. I did have an interpreter. The interpreter was a 417 member. 417 would be the equivalent of our Secret Service, except this guy worked for Yasser Arafat, one of the world's great terrorists.
All right, and so now, of course, you're going to meet the some of the terrorists, but you know you're not just going to meet one group. You're going to be representatives of several groups of terrorists, and they're going to try to talk to you, hopefully that you will actually be sympathetic to their point of view, or at least you'll get their information out. So
that's why they're meeting with me.
So what happens next?
Well, you find out that there are two entirely different kinds of terrorists, and you know, I should have known this just based upon history and current events. There are socialist or communist terrorists, and there are fundamentalist Islamic terrorists. We've been dealing with the religious nature of communism and the terror that it inspires for better part of 50 years now, and really just beginning in the last decade or so to see the incredible pain of fundamental Islamic terror. The first group were socialists. They were members of the Fatah Party. That's a socialist party. It's the single-party system that supports Yasser Arafat. These guys were members of the Askha Martyrs Brigade. The thing that was so chilling about them is that they had killed 11 Jewish women and children just 2 days prior to me meeting with them. And they were very proud of what they had done because they said they weren't terrorists. They were, in their mind, army men, and that's what they kept on saying during the meeting, because they blew off the axle of the bus and shot the women and children as they fled the bus with M16s. Therefore, they weren't terrorists, they were soldiers. Shaking the hands of three people, a captain and two lieutenants, that had just murdered in cold blood 11 women and children is horrifying. And what was even more horrifying is these people were rational. They could carry on an intelligent conversation. They were well-educated. What was particularly frightening, though, is the M16s that they had with them and that they used to conduct those murders were supplied by the U.S. taxpayer. And the training for the two lieutenants that were part of this meeting was provided courtesy of our CIA in Virginia.
All right. Now, of course, was this money that was being and weapons that were being sent to Yasser Arafat, who is a lifelong terrorist? I mean, is there any question in your mind at all that the whole history of Yasser Arafat is that of a terrorist?
Well, I've studied the history of Yasser Arafat. Yasser Arafat is probably the greatest terrorist of the last 100 years. He has a long, proud history. He is really a socialist. He's not a Muslim. He was recruited by the KGB. The PLO was founded by Nasser, who was, as you know, the leader of Egypt, also a socialist. And his political party, which he did found, is a communist party. But he is a diabolical terrorist that has masterminded everything from the terrorist events of the Munich Games to the Achille Lauro to the bombing of and hijacking of passenger airliners ad infinitum. In fact, he's the guy that is responsible for virtually all of the terrorist activities inside of Israel today.
And I think many of our listeners may have forgotten the Achille Lauro was when they actually shot one of the passengers who was an American. They killed him in cold blood. And this was an organization that was answerable to Yasser Arafat. And yet, this is the darling, this is the man that we have been doing, supported and, you know, sort of eulogized. And for it always seems like he's such a good guy, and we negotiate with him. And, you know, we... and, of course, the American people, I don't think, understand that we've been helping to finance Yasser Arafat for many years and train his people. Why would we do something that dumb?
Well, first of all, the United States State Department is probably the dumbest, most corrupt institution in the history of America. And the more that I began to study the actions of the terrorists, the more I was appalled by the actions of the United States State Department. We always are on the wrong side of everything virtually all the time. It is just repulsive. You know that during the Clinton administration, the single most frequent international political person to visit the White House was Yasser Arafat?
No, I wouldn't be at all surprised.
America's national shrine, if you will, having this bloodthirsty terrorist as a regular visitor makes my blood run cold. But these guys all talked about the fact they reported directly to them, and they were murdering thugs, articulate murdering thugs. Now, I'll tell you that as bad as they were extremely frightened by, literally scared of, the fundamental Islamic terrorists. And they hated the fundamental Islamic terrorists, just as the Islamic terrorists hated the socialist terrorists. That's why you hear in Osama bin Laden's recorded messages that he labels Saddam Hussein an infidel. He hates Saddam Hussein, and Saddam Hussein hates Osama bin Laden. Well, they have a common enemy, us infidels. They detest one another. And this first group of terrorists, these political terrorists, Fatah and Oscar Martyrs Brigade, told me several things about the second group that I later confirmed in my question of them, which is, first, they're growing extraordinarily fast to the point where they are probably already now the majority of the Arabs living inside of Israel, and they probably represent somewhere in the range of 25% of the Islamic world as a whole. These are fundamentalist Muslims committed to living their life as close to the Prophet Muhammad as absolutely possible. Bloodthirsty terrorists, these are.
No, I think that the point you're making is the fact that that basically this Islamic movement is growing very rapidly within the Muslim faith. I mean, up until a few years ago, there were not that very many of the Islamic people. In other words, people who had accepted jihad as part of the Muslim faith, but
there weren't very many good Muslims, we should say.
Right. The
Quran defines good and bad Muslims in America. This is if there's one message I'd like to leave with America as we're having this discussion, is the Quran's definition of a good and bad Muslim. Allah, who, by the way, is no more God than you and I are. He was literally a figment of Muhammad's imagination, but that's not what Muslims think. They think that he really was a deity. But Allah defines a bad Muslim as a peaceful Muslim, as a Muslim who will not leave their home to fight jihad in his cause. And so if you are a peaceful Muslim, what your God thinks of you is the following, that you are the worst of creatures, the most vile of animals. That's directly out of the Quran. So if you are a peaceful Muslim, or if you know a peaceful Muslim, their God hates them. Now, a good Muslim is also defined repeatedly in the Quran, and a good Muslim is one who fights jihad in Allah's cause. And the Quran orders Muslims to continue to fight the infidels until one of three things happens. We either all submit to the religion of Islam, we pay the protective or jihad tax in submission or in humility. It's kind of like the mafia. You pay me or I kill you, that kind of tax. Or number three, that they kill you. So you can die, you can become a Muslim, or you can commit financial suicide. And they are commanded to continue to fight us until one of those three events occur.
All right, fine. And I think it's we're going to get back. We're going to talk about the five basic tenets of the Muslim faith. And then, of course, that there is a fifth tenet that has been introduced, a sixth tenet that's been introduced by the Islamists. And there's a difference between the Muslim faith and really this radical Islamic faith that is growing so rapidly across the world today. And I think it's vitally important that the American people understand that. When people tell you that Islam means peace, they're really not telling you the truth. We'll be right back here with our special guest. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our special guest this evening is Craig Wynn, and he's written a wonderful book. It's called Tea with Terrorists, telling about, of course, his experiences there on the in the West Bank area, and then, of course, what he has learned about the Islamic faith. So I think this is a good time to perhaps develop this idea. You know, there are five tenets of Islam. Would you like to tell us, our listeners, about the five tenets of Islam, and then the sixth tenet, which has been added by these Islamic, these people, who you would describe as good Muslims?
Well, certainly. The fact is that the fifth tenet, the sixth tenet, if you will, wasn't added later. It is the core part of the Islamic belief, and according to Muhammad, it was the single most important thing. According to Allah, it's the single most important tenet in all of Islam, and that is jihad. The tenets before that, the five, it's interesting, are all reflective in this grand religious scam that was created by Muhammad's great-great-grandfather, Qusay. And all five of the pillars, the Hajj, the recognition of Allah, the fasting and reverence for the month of Ramadan, the prayers five times a day, all of these things were actually part of a religious scam, a get-rich-quick scheme that Muhammad's great-great-grandfather invented and Muhammad coveted, and he was cut out of when he was born because he was orphaned by his father at birth and abandoned by his mother. The real tenet of Islam is jihad. Muhammad in the hadith, probably in the range of 100 times, calls jihad the single greatest deed that a Muslim can do. Allah says in his Quran, as well as Muhammad in the hadith, that the only guarantee of paradise is to die a martyr killing infidels. As a matter of fact, if you kill an infidel, the blood of the infidel that is on the martyr's body is not washed off so that Allah might immediately recognize this person is worthy of being led directly into his brothel.
Now, I think it's important that our listeners understand there are two basic books, as it were, that the Muslim reads. One, of course, is the Quran, which everybody talks about. What is this hadith that you read?
The hadith. Yeah, the hadith is the sayings of the prophet. See, the Quran is arguably the worst book ever written. The Quran has no chronological order, which means that there is no, you know, you think of the Bible in any religious book, you start at the beginning and you go kind of go through time. Well, the Quran is, if anything, it's reversed, but it's just literally thrown together. There is no context in the Quran. So when Muslims say, oh boy, you just quoted that verse out of context, how could you do that? You can't take the Quran out of context because there is no context. There's no transitions. Things aren't even organized by subject matter. And most of it's plagiarized. So it is just a horrible book that by itself is useless. So to make a religion, and by the way, Islam is far more a political doctrine than it is a religion, by far more political doctrine than religion. To make a religion, these guys in a political doctrine scheme, they had to have the sayings of the prophet and they had to have the context of the prophet's life. And that's particularly important for a good Muslim, a terrorist Muslim, because the Quran says that the best example, if you want to end up in Allah's brothel, they don't call it Allah's brothel, but they describe it as a place where there's multiple virgins satiating the carnal desires of these martyrs. That sounds like a brothel to me. The rivers flow with wine. Sounds like a brothel to me.
I'll be right back to my special guest this evening. All right, our guest this evening is Craig Wynn, and we're talking about, of course, the basic Muslim belief and how so much of this is built upon a book known as the Hadith. So go ahead, pick up the story.
Sure. There are lots of different Hadith in the Islamic faith, although there's only four that are universally accepted. Two by subject, one called Muslim, the other one by Al-Bukhari. Al-Bukhari's is the favorite. Got one right here in my lap as I'm speaking to you. Two that are arranged chronologically. These hadiths now are the oral reports, the sayings of the prophets, his life and deeds. And the two that are by chronology, which is really the most useful, because organized that way you can come to understand what this guy Muhammad was like and you understand the basic foundations of Islam. So when I talk about fundamental Islam as the root cause of terror, it's because the hadiths arranged chronologically depict a prophet who was a terrorist. The best two there are Ibn Ishaq, which was the first written. Unfortunately, it doesn't exist anymore, and there's only an edited version by Ibn Hisham. And then there's Al-Tabari, and Al-Tabari is the most comprehensive list of these hadiths done in chronological order. It would be the best source for an American wanting to know the truth about Islam. I would suggest buying volumes 6, 7, and 8 of the history of Al-Tabari, and that would be the best way to look at hadith organized chronologically.
All right, and of course, then, of course, after you return from your tea with the terrorist, why then you set out to study the writings of the not only Muhammad but these other documents to really understand the fundamentals of the Islamic belief. Is that right?
That's right, Stan. Dr. Stan, the reason for that was that when I asked the terrorists why they were killing us, what I expected them to say was that they were following signposts along the road. That was written by Qutb, who was an Egyptian educator. And Qutb is the Martin Luther of the modern Islamic terrorist movement. He's the guy that took Islamic terror away from being a good Muslim against a bad Muslim doctrine. You know, the Wahhabis that we in America think are responsible for corrupting Islam and being the source of rage for terrorism, ultimate nonsense. The Wahhabis were good Muslims who killed bad Muslims. But Qutb changed all that. He took Islam and made it an equal opportunity hate and violence organization, quoting directly out of the Hadith and the Quran, because the Quran, in fact, does order Muslims to kill infidels, which the Quran defines as anyone who calls Christ the Messiah, and Jews. So I expected them to quote from Qutb, and that would be their motivation. That's not what they did. They quoted directly out of the Hadith. They quoted directly out of the Quran. They were quoting fundamental Islam, the original, uncorrupted Islam of the Prophet Muhammad. So when I got back, I figured, boy, I tell you what, I better find out what these books actually say and see if there's a way to really understand the Quran, to put it in chronological order, to put it in context. One of the things, Dr. Stan, that most people don't recognize is the Quran is so badly written and so foolish and so demented. Muhammad knew that anyone who questioned it, anyone who thought about it with an open mind, would immediately reject it and say, this deity is far too stupid to be God, and he's too demented to be God. There is no way this is a divine book. And so in the last surah revealed, Muhammad, speaking on behalf of his God, Allah, says that no Muslim should ever question the Quran, and that any Muslim who does question the Quran will lose their faith. And then in the Hadith, he says, any Muslim who rejects his faith must be killed.
And, of course, I think one of the most interesting things is that they really don't see anything wrong with killing other Muslims. They certainly are not going along with this radical form of Islam. Won't they kill Muslims who reject this idea of the jihad? I can't.
Fundamentalist. And so the fundamentalist, pure, good Muslims have murdered bad Muslims, peaceful Muslims, and by the millions over these 14 centuries. It's not until quite recently that they have returned to slaughtering infidels. As you know, within the 100 years of the creation of this doctrine by Muhammad, the Bedouins, who had been freedom-loving and peaceful people, for 3,100 years turned warlike, and over the next 100 years they lashed out with the sword and conquered much of the world, from France all the way to India. But they had been focused on killing one another until quite recently.
We're going to have to political interrupt you there. We'll be right back in just a moment with Craig Wynn talking about his book, Tea with Terrorists. Well, Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Craig Wynn, and he's written a fascinating book called Tea with Therapists, based not only upon his personal experience dealing with the terrorists there in a bunker in the West Bank, but also studying the writings of the Islamists. And, of course, what he's come up with is a concept which is really sometimes a little difficult to understand, but it is quite accurate. And that is, of course, that the good Muslim is the one who embraces jihad and would kill any infidel. The bad Muslim is the one, of course, who states he's a Muslim, but he really does not wrapped up in this radical, violent approach to life and, of course, towards his fellow man. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, and that definition is not mine. That comes directly out of the Quran. Surahs 3, 8, and 33 all define good and bad Muslims. And as I said, Allah hates the peaceful Muslim. So if you're a peace-loving Muslim, you could well be a good person. If you're a bad Muslim, you could well be a loving and kind person, but your God hates you. That's not a good place to be in.
All right, fine. We're going to be here in just a moment here, and we'll be talking to our special guest, who is, of course, Craig Wynn. All right, Craig, are you there? No, I can't hear Craig. So,
hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Are we back on again?
Yes, we're having just a little technical problem tonight. You'll have to abide with us. Our board went out. We just got a new board. My engineers had to be working on that just at that moment.
Okay.
But anyway, you go ahead and sort of develop this idea. Such an important thing, concept for our listeners.
Yes, what I was saying is that the idea of good and bad Muslim is not mine. It comes directly out of the Quran. It comes from Surahs 3, 8, and 33, where Allah repeatedly describes the nature of a good Muslim and a bad Muslim. And as I said, a good Muslim is a jihadist, someone who fights in Allah's cause with their wealth and their life. And a bad Muslim is one who will not leave their homes to fight in Allah's cause. One of the things, Dr. Stan, that I want to impress on your audience is how overwhelming this is for anyone that's listening to think that, oh, this guy's just taking selected verses out of context, and boy, you could do this with any religious book. That just is not true. When you read the history of Al-Tabari, which is this best collection of hadiths put in chronological order, and you go to year one of the Islamic era, that's when Muhammad left Mecca in shame and went into to Yathrib. What you find is that 395 of the 400 pages that deal with that period, 395 of the 400 pages are dedicated to violence, thievery, and immorality. It opens with the best description in the world of the political doctrine of Islam, and that is fear. The same thing that controls Saddam Hussein's world. So fear is the cornerstone of this thing, and that was his first sermon. In fact, he mentioned the word fear 13 times in 15 sentences. Goes from there to pedophilia. Now, a 53-year-old man having sex with a 9-year-old girl is pedophilia. My view is that there's no way that a pedophile is a prophet of God.
All right, let's just explain, of course, Muhammad had taken this very, very young girl to be one of his wife. Is that correct? All right, fine. We can't hear Craig, or Craig can't hear us, so we'll apologize for the problems. But
Can you hear me now?
Okay, I can hear you.
Okay. You just said that Muhammad took Aisha to be his wife. He was when he married her, she was 6 years old and he was 50 years old. The hadith says that when he consummated the marriage, she was 9 and he was 53. That's pedophilia by any description, and pedophiles are not prophets. By the way, in the same book, the same hadith has vivid depictions of Muhammad being involved in incest, where he married his daughter-in-law, has him be involved in rape, and sometimes the rape is beyond just disgusting. It's utterly perverse, where he would make Jewish women watch the murder of their sons and husbands, and after having watched them be murdered by his militants, he would take these women and rape them himself and give others to his men as a reward, a form of booty. He was a very sick man. Now, from that point, after we deal with the immorality, we move directly to terrorism. There are 12 terrorist raids in a row, all perpetrated by Muhammad, and he moves from terrorism to assassinations, where he assassinates in individual assassinations 12 journalists, tells his people to wipe out every Jew, kill every Jew under their control, and he goes from that to genocide, where he takes settlement after settlement of Jews in northern Arabia, surrounds them, starves them, and then steals everything they have, takes the men, cuts off their heads, sells the children into slavery, and allows his men to have the women as sex slaves.
Well, he doesn't sound like a very nice individual, and yet this is the man, the founder of the Muhammadan religion. And of course, what I think that people don't really understand is that by the very essence of this religion, it's a violent religion. It doesn't mean every Muslim is a violent individual, but the Muslims who are not violent are the ones who are really not following the tenets of the faith. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes. Everything that I have just shared comes directly out of their scripture. And this is not some historical account that somebody that hated Islam wrote. There is no historical account of Muhammad written within 300 years of his life. The only source of information is their scripture. So the stories I'm telling you are the depictions that come out of their scripture, and they're 99% violent and immoral. So if you're a fundamentalist of any doctrine, it is your duty to study the words of your prophet or the founder of your doctrine and to try to emulate their deeds. And so anyone who studies the words of the Prophet Muhammad as they are depicted in the Hadith and tries to have their life emulate his lifestyle, they will be identical to Osama bin Laden.
All right, fine. So now you're there in the bunker. You're really have no means of getting out. You've got a couple of friends with you. And after talked to the first people, and these, of course, are the socialist terrorists or the Marxist terrorists, and you refer those to as part of the Fatah, is it?
His country. Yeah, last time he ran against a 72-year-old social worker, a woman, as a matter of fact, in an Islamic world, it's a one-party system, and that one party happens to be a terrorist party called Fatah.
All right, fine. So then, of course, then they bring in the next set of... is there anything else you wanted to tell us about the first group, other than the fact that they say, well, really not so bad. Where do we meet the next fella that's coming down the line?
Yeah, they said this next group are absolutely crazy, and what they warned me against, and first, I guess I should share that the first group of terrorists, the socialist terrorists, loved America. They loved America. They said, your media is unbelievably kind to us. We get along fabulously with the American media, and your government funds our activities. So we are reliant on the American government for funds, and your media is very kind to us, and they were very bullish on America. Now,
go ahead, Craig. Now, of course, now they're going to, of course, take you to bring in the next group.
They brought in the next group, and the next group was an entirely different kind of individual. These people were irrational. There was no reaching them. Logic, history, reason, nothing prevailed. You know, you've seen those pictures where the videos where the militants are celebrating martyrdom and banging themselves and holding their guns up in the air and walking down the streets and celebrating the suicide bombers, and you look at, you see the look in their eyes. Well, that was the look of everyone that walked into the room next. And what's interesting is that while the socialist terrorists hate the fundamental Islamic terrorists, all of the fundamentalist Islamic terrorists love each other. There is no difference between Hezbollah and Hamas and Islamic Jihad and the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda. These organizations are identical. They all read the same hadiths. They follow the same prophet. They quote from the same Quran. Their leader is the Prophet Muhammad.
But, of course, who is financing this group of people? Are these people, this next group that you're talking about, are these the ones that are financed by Saudi Arabia?
Not a coincidence that 15 of the 19 suicide bombers of 9/11 were Saudis. The Saudis, according to these terrorists, provide them with hundreds of millions of dollars. And in addition to the Saudis, they are their next largest benefactor are the Iranians, followed by the Egyptians, followed by the Iraqis, followed by the Syrians. Big money. In fact, these guys are mercenaries. The family of a suicide bomber can make anywhere from 50 or 60,000 bucks, which is, you know, a lifetime's earnings for them, and get a new house if their terrorist act was average to less than dramatic, to if it was a really dramatic terrorist act, they make millions. And the biggest benefactors are the Saudis.
All right. In other words, what you're saying is that the Saudis are really financing a lot of this radical Islamic movement, and, of course, our government's really not doing anything at all about that.
Worse than not doing anything about it, we coddle them. I mean, you know where command and control is for the war on Iraq, you know. The Iraqis had nothing to do with 9/11, and yet we spent $3 billion worth of bombs today destroying Iraq. The Saudis were the principal reason that 9/11 happened. They're the nation that fund and manufacture more terrorists than any other place on Earth, and yet our command and control is right there. They're, you know, the prince goes and gets a personal invite to George Bush's ranch. We are, as a nation, completely lost when it comes to responding effectively to the fundamental Islamic terror that was responsible for 9/11 and every other act of terrorism on America for the last 20 years.
Well, you know, Craig, I'm not so sure that our leaders are as foolish as you're suggesting they are. I mean, I disagree with them totally, but I believe that the attack on Iraq is just the first in a series of wars, because I think that once we get there, we're going to station our troops, a couple of hundred thousand of them there, and then I believe we're going to go after Iran and probably Syria and Saudi Arabia down the line. I believe that that we're not telling the American people that, because the American people are not yet ready to be told the truth. They don't want to hear the truth. They want to hear Saddam Hussein is the really bad guy, and he's responsible for all of our troubles, and he is somehow was responsible for 9/11. And I know I don't believe our leaders think that for one minute. I think that they're simply lying to the American people to justify what's going on. But I really do believe that they're going to be many, many more wars in the Middle East. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think there is a solution to terror, but spending $200 billion and trying to create a democracy in Iraq without understanding and dealing with the root cause, which is fundamental Islam, is a great waste of life and of money and of resolve, if you will. So, yes, I do think there's going to be a lot more wars in the Middle East, but I think there's going to be a lot more wars because America is leadership and America's media is lost. I wish that you were right, and that our politicians are deceiving us because they have a grand plan in place, and this is just the first stage of a grand plan. But I don't think so. I think that that America is afraid to even discuss fundamental Islam. The political correct crowd are control, particularly the television media. The truth does not get through. I get dozens of emails a week from members of the American intelligence community and from armed forces, where they repeatedly say that anyone who even speaks of the correlation between Islam, fundamental Islam, and terrorism, is relieved of duty. And that's true in our CIA, it's true in our FBI, it's true in our military. I believe there will be many more wars in the Middle East, but they won't be as a result of a wise strategy on America's behalf. I think they will be the result of a failed policy.
Well, I'm not saying that I think the war is really going to be successful, but I share with you your concern for what you're talking about. Now, let's talk a little bit about this second group that comes in, and where do these people fit in? Are these people a part of Al-Qaeda? Are they part of some other Islamic terrorist movement?
Second group of terrorists are fundamental Muslim terrorists. They're every question that you ask them, they quote directly out of the Quran and out of the Hadith. It's just like Osama bin Laden's speeches, where we try to analyze them. All the man's doing is quoting out of the Hadith and the Quran. So these men believe that it is their duty to be at war with us. And the more we talked, the more they hated me, the more they wanted to kill me.
All right, fine. So then, of course, were these people threatening to you at all?
Oh, yeah. They accused me of being CIA, which shows you how delusional they are. We don't have any CIA agents in the fundamental Islamic world. But they accused me of being CIA. They began to flail with their guns. The 417 member that was the host of this event began to become very agitated. He would tell me repeatedly that you need to stop challenging them. They have the guns. They think you're CIA. They want to kill you. And that's how Tea with Terrorists got named Tea with Terrorists, is that one of the things he did to try to keep them from shooting me was he brought down this porcelain tea set, thinking that it was going to be hard for them to pull the trigger on their guns if their trigger finger was holding a porcelain teacup full of a hot beverage. And so he brought this down, and we continued to have a very agitated conversation as they would explain what they see in their media. One of the things that became painfully clear is that they're taught to hate us in their schools. They're taught to hate us in their mosques. They're taught to hate us by their media. Al Jazeera is probably the single worst institution on the planet today as it relates to corrupting the minds of these fundamentalist Muslims.
You know, one of the most amazing things is the realization that our USAID organization, United States Aid and Information Aid Organization, had actually put up $56 million for textbooks that were used in Afghanistan to train young Islamic boys in this whole radical Islamic belief, going right along with killing the infidels. We financed that, and we have the articles out of the Washington Post talking about this massive investment for textbooks to indoctrinate the youth of Afghanistan in radical Islam. Why would you do that?
Well, it's the same thing as the mission of Iraq. Well, militarily, obviously, we will prevail. I don't know how many Americans will die in the process, but we will prevail militarily, but we will not prevail in establishing a democracy there because of the fact that fundamental Islam is wholly inconsistent with democracy. There never has been a democracy in that region, and there's not going to be one. It's the same thing with us giving out these textbooks that are consistent with the textbooks each one of these Islamic countries gives their children. We are universally so ignorant of the nature of the doctrines that kill us that America constantly either loses the war or loses the peace Sometimes we win the war, as we will in Iraq, but we'll lose the peace. And we'll lose the peace because we do not understand the nature of the doctrine that causes men to kill us. The same thing was true in Vietnam, by the way. We lost both the war and the peace there because we didn't understand the religious component of communism. And when they sent enough of us home in body bags, we gave up.
Well, you know, the thing bothers me is that do we know anything at all about the impact of this radical form of Islam, the what you refer to as the good Islamic movement within Iraq? Certainly we know it's growing within the Palestinian segment. We know it's growing in Turkey. It's certainly growing within Pakistan and Afghanistan. It's growing throughout the world almost like a forest fire, this yes. radical Islamic belief. And our policies, it would seem to be like fanning this fire. We're doing everything we can to promote it on one hand, and then we're horrified that it's there. But had this radical form of Islam actually infiltrated Iraq as well?
Right. It's fundamental Islam. The best guess that I have is that about 25% of Muslims are good Muslims, which means they're terrorists. One of the things that I don't think America knows is that the entire region is unbelievably unstable, not only because of its poverty and because of its tyranny, but also because of the fact that 65% of the population in all of these Islamic countries is under the age of 25. There has never been a society that has been able to survive that without some form of revolution. And these young people are far more susceptible to fundamental Islam than are the older generation. Now, in Iraq, several things have happened. The party that runs Iraq, the Ba'ath Party, is a Nazi party. It's a socialist party in the Nazi genre. And Saddam knows that there just are not enough socialists to inflict enough damage on the Americans for him to have any chance of succeeding. But he also knows that there's enough Muslims that there is a chance that the fundamentalist Muslims will die as martyrs killing Americans thinking that they're going to be brought to Allah's brothel in paradise. And so he added the words, Allah is great, which is the prayer that all Muslim terrorists utter before they kill innocent people below the Iraqi flag quite recently. He traded in his AK-47 and now you see him with his prayer blankie. He's building, mosques as well as palaces. And even in his speeches, he starts all of his speeches in religious Arabic and then transitions into conversational Arabic. In his last speech, he used the word jihad, I think 11 times in a very, very short speech.
In other words, basically, he's pandering to the Islamic radicals within his society, although he himself really is more or less a secular Muslim, isn't he?
I don't think he's a Muslim at all. I think it's the same thing with Yasser Arafat. Yasser Arafat's not a Muslim, but he certainly panders to it because that's his power base. And Islam is a tool that people use. There really is very little chance that any person in the hierarchy of an Islamic country that is well educated, whether they be cleric or just dictator or thug, actually believes Islam. But Islam is a powerful tool for cleric and king to use to suppress the people.
And certainly we see this in Saudi Arabia, where the Saudi monarchy is validated by the religion, by the religious leaders, Wahhabi leaders, and yes. the Wahhabi leaders are validated by the monarchy. And so there's a symbiotic relationship, and yet, of course, the leaders in Saudi Arabia are really totally dependent upon this whole Islamic movement to keep them in power. Isn't that true?
It's really the devil's own bargain here. The leaders of Saudi Arabia routinely go off around the world. The Bahamas is one of their favorite places, but they go off and they're very perverse when they leave their home country. Prostitutes and drinking and really despicable kinds of behavior, all of which is illegal in the Islamic world. And so they play at Islam for the express purpose of being able to control and suppress their people. See, the Quran says that he who fears will behave, he who fears will mind. And so Islam is a doctrine, a political doctrine, based upon fear, and suppression. In fact, the word Islam means submission. It is a political doctrine, very, very similar to Nazism and to communism.
And of course,
totalitarian at its core.
That's not, of course, what our leaders are telling us. They're telling us, oh, the word Islam means peace. Now,
it means submission.
It means submission. I think that's so vitally important. Even our leaders are not telling us the truth.
No, in fact, there is no peace in the Quran. The only two places where peace is mentioned in the Quran, it's part of a deception. Muslims are told to tell us infidels peace until it is too late. See, both the Hadith and the Quran encourage Muslims to lie to us infidels. In fact, the Quran says that any agreement, any treaty between Muslims and infidels is not binding on the Muslims. As a matter of fact, one of the great examples here is that in the Oslo Accords that did not give Yasser Arafat all of Jerusalem, when he came back, he knew he would be a dead man because of the fact that he signed those accords if he could not somehow satiate the desires, appease the desires, if you will, of the fundamentalist Muslims. So he came back and said, in Arabic, I signed this in the spirit of the Treaty of Hudaybiyah. And every Muslim knew what that was. Hudaybiyah was when Muhammad signed a treaty with the Meccans saying that he was going to have 10 years of peace. When he went back the next year, built up his military, came back and sieged them. And so the treaty was used as a form of deception. And that's what these guys say in Arabic. It's why no treaty ever signed by any Muslim leader has ever been honored.
Well, I think there's just so much here that the average American doesn't understand, and that is that the true Muslim faith, and as you refer to them as a good Muslim, are those people who have accepted the five tenets of the Muslim faith, and then the sixth tenet of the Islamic faith, which is really of jihad, and that means this constant struggle, this constant effort to destroy the infidel, and to destroy anyone who doesn't agree with their religion. That would be a fair statement?
It's a wholly accurate statement. Jihad does not mean spiritual struggle. It is a call to arms. The Quran describes it as going off with full force of cavalry and weaponry to wage war on all non-Muslims. And so it has nothing to do with a spiritual struggle and everything to do with them going off and attacking us. In fact, let me read the Hadith. This is the Hadith's own description of jihad. It says, jihad, holy fighting in Allah's cause with full force and number of weaponry, is given the utmost importance in Islam and one of its pillars upon which it stands. By jihad, Islam is established. Allah's word is made superior, which means none has the right to be worshipped but Allah, one world religion.
All right, we're going to be back. We're going to have to interrupt you here. We're going to have to take a break, and we'll be back in just a moment. Our special guest this evening is Craig Wynn. When we get back, we're going to tell you how to get copies of his book, Tea with Terrorists, because he actually went to meet with a terrorist. It's a fascinating, fascinating story. We'll be right back here in just a moment with our special guest for the evening. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king, but in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion that'll determine what the future will bring. And, of course, our special guest this evening is Mr. Craig Wynn, and his book is Tea with Terrace. And, Craig, before we go on, would you like to tell our listeners how they can get copies of your book?
Well, certainly. It's available in most bookstores, both secular and Christian bookstores. It's available in all of the online stores like Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Books A Million and the like. And there's also a website, teawithterrorists.com. Any one of those avenues, they can get the book.
All right, fine. And the book is Tea with Terrace. And do you want to put out your telephone number where they can get it?
I think it's best just to go to the website or go to a bookstore. I think would probably be the easiest way to buy it. It's well distributed. Our only challenge is keeping up with demand. We don't seem to be able to print them as fast as people are buying them. So that's a good thing, since the message is important for America. I think it's a message that could keep America alive, both both physically and spiritually. There's a very strong spiritual component to the book, as well as a unequivocal presentation of who the terrorists are, why they kill, and what ultimately we can do to stop them.
And, of course, I think that the important thing is that our listeners understand that we're dealing, contrary to what you're being told, we're dealing with the tenets of a religious faith, and as this faith is growing very, very rapidly, it is being adopted by more and more people, and it is a faith which is founded in violence, not in love, not in compassion, not at all like Christianity. It is based upon this intense hatred of anybody, of course, who does not accept the radical form of Islamic belief, which is included in jihad. So let's get back. You're sitting there in the basement of this bunker, and of course you're talking with these people. They're getting increasingly more agitated. Now, are these the second group you're talking with, Al-Qaeda, or what group are they associated with?
Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah, and Islamic Jihad. One thing, Dr. Stan, I would like to say, and I hope this has come across. If it hasn't, then I need to make the point, which is that yes, indeed, what we are doing here, and I'll take responsibility, what I am doing here is I am exposing Islam as it is presented in its scriptures, the Quran and the Hadith. And I am telling your listeners that the Islam that is presented in the Quran and the Hadith is a terrorist manifesto. It is more racist and hateful than Mein Kampf, the book that began Nazism. But being disgusted by a perverse doctrine is entirely different than being disgusted by people. I am not, do not hate Muslims. As a matter of fact, I love Muslims. I'll lay down my life to save Muslims. And we as Americans must not hate Muslims. We must hate this doctrine that causes them to kill us, and we must love them enough to be willing to risk both blood and coin to free them from this doctrine. Because until we free them from this doctrine, we have no chance of freeing ourselves from fundamental Islamic terror. And it's the story is exactly the same as Nazi Germany. We did not need to go out and hate Germans and kill Germans. What we needed to do was identify the nature of Nazism, and we needed to defeat Nazism. And when we did, we freed Germans from that tyranny. And by freeing them, we ended up freeing ourselves from the terror that they inflicted on the world. The same thing is true with Islam. These people have no freedoms of movement. They have no freedoms of speech. They have no freedoms of thought. They have no freedoms of religion. And they live in terrible poverty, intellectual poverty, spiritual poverty, economic poverty. We must care enough about them to want to free them from this terrible doctrine.
And I think that is a very noble view, and certainly something that needs to be done. The problem is, of course, that this whole radical form of Islam is actually being funded by our good friends in Saudi Arabia. And until the American people understand that, and then we have to ask the question, if that indeed is true, then why is it that our government is not addressing that issue? Why is our government doing everything to prevent lawsuits being filed by the families of the victims of 9/11 against the Saudi princes, many of whom have been active funders of this whole Al-Qaeda radical Islamic movement? Would you want to just sort of develop on that point before we go on further?
The mother's milk of politics is money, my friend. And amongst the largest contributors to many of our most esteemed politicians these Arabian nations and Americans who receive money from them. The fact of the matter is that they have hundreds of billions of dollars invested in our economy because we won't drill for oil offshore or in Anwar. We are dependent on their oil. Our economy is dependent on their investments. And our politicians are dependent on their contributions. And so it's all about the money.
Well, that, of course, is a tragic commentary, especially when we realize that American boys' lives are going to be lost. And not only that, but an awful lot of Muslims' lives will be lost because we're not addressing the real issue. I mean, here, certainly 15 of the 19 terrorists came from Saudi Arabia. Osama bin Laden came from Saudi Arabia. We know that the Saudi princes have been funding Al-Qaeda, and it wasn't just before 9/11. They've continued funding it after that.
That's correct.
And so now we're attacking Iraq. And, you know, of course, a lot of the people out there demonstrating against the war are quite irrational. They're against war. They're against taking a stand on anything.
That's
a lot of them are Marxists and communists. But there is some very real reason for being opposed to the war. Now, once we're in it, let's get it over with. Let's get it done. Let's stop the violence as much as we can. But let's also be objective of the fact that the real force behind this whole movement was not Saddam Hussein, as wicked and evil as he is, but was the Saudi Arabian princes who have consistently funded Al-Qaeda. And although our guest this evening has made the point that some of the funding for Islamic terrorism has come from Saddam, he's way down the line in the feeding chain, isn't he?
Yeah, if you were to list the countries that are the manufacturing organizations for fundamentalist Islamic terrorists, Saudi Arabia would be first, Iran would be second, Egypt is the thought leader of the fundamental Islamic world. They would be third. Syria and Iraq would be tied in the fourth position, and then probably Libya. And by the way, I think that your audience knows you well enough, and I'd like to make it very clear. I am not a peacenik. I'm a firm believer that the only path to peace is a strong shield and a sharp sword, and that the peace process has always led directly to war, as it did with the appeasement of Czechoslovakia to Hitler, which ignited World War II, the abandonment, the peace for land for peace process in Israel, if the president gets his way and forces Israel to give up Judea and Samaria, that will lead directly to World War III. I am hugely in favor of the men and women that serve in our armed forces. I think they are the best our nation has. They are courageous. They are disciplined. They are fine people. And I want all the best for them, and I pray for them. My problem is that our politicians make decisions that are either ignorant or arrogant or both that put our men in harm's way for the wrong reason.
Amen to that. Well, our telephone number, if you're out in the listening audience and you have a question or comment, our telephone number here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. That's 464-8295. And out across America is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Our guest is Craig Wynn. His book is Tea with Terrorists. And it's a fascinating story. Really, it goes into the background of his actual interview with these terrorists, but of course it's really more or less written from a fictional point of view, isn't it?
Well, it's got more fact in it than I think any nonfiction book ever written on the correlation between fundamental Islam and terror. But I embedded the truth in the form of a novel for several reasons. One is there are so many interrelated pieces to this. With characters, I could have them move through all of the interrelated pieces. The problems politically in America, the problems of America separating themselves from our Creator, the geopolitical nature of the problem, the history and the similarities between communism, fascism, and Islam, the history of the fundamental Islamic movement, as well as the scriptures themselves. And I needed to pull all that together, and the novel just became the best mechanism, not only to pull it together, but to make the education of America entertaining, so that more people would read the story than would ever read it if it was just a typical dry scholarly tome style of a book.
All right, fine. Well, let's go to Zachariah, who's calling in here from Soquel, and it says that Zachariah has never been on the radio before. Zachariah, are you there?
Yeah, how you doing?
Doing fine.
Yeah, I'm just at work right now. I was just curious because, like, I can understand there being a lot of uneducated Muslims around the world, but I live in America, and I know a lot of educated Muslims, right? And I talk to them, and I'm like, and I heard this, you know, whole deal. Aren't Muslims, like, aren't they supposed to want to kill me, you know, because I'm not a Muslim? Like, oh, no, we don't want to this or that. We're totally peaceful, and, you know, and I meet all these people, and they read up on the Quran. It's not like they don't. I'm curious, how is that possible?
All right, and I think that's a very good question, Zachariah. Why don't you go ahead and answer that?
Yeah, I debate Muslim scholars all the time on the radio, and what I find is that the Muslim scholars know their Quran reasonably, well, know the Quran very well, and they know their Hadith reasonably well, but outside of imams and folks with PhDs in Islamic scripture and history, most Muslims do not know their Hadith very well. And if they were to know their Hadith, they would reject their faith. What I do routinely when I get a phone call from a Muslim who is not a cleric, as I say, I'll tell you what, I'm going to give you a challenge here. I want you to go buy the History of Al-Tabari, volumes 6, 7, and 8. I want you to read them. And when you read them, I'm going to give you a way to contact me. If I have misstated the nature of this doctrine, then I'll print a retraction and I'll cease and desist. But if I have not misstated the nature of this doctrine, then may I suggest a new prophet and a new religion, because it's obviously way too violent and way too perverse to be godly. Now, what has been interesting is that many Muslims listening to these debates have called up the stations later and said that they took that challenge and, in fact, found that what I was saying was true and have left Islam.
And, you know, it's really, I'm sorry, Zachariah is no longer with us, but we actually interviewed a missionary who's been in Kurdistan. He's a friend of mine. He's been over there for a year and a half. They have a school there, and they've got to know a lot of the Muslims there. And most of these Muslims cannot read Arabic. I mean, they can read. I don't know what they can. They can't read the classic Arabic. They can't read
the classic Arabic of the Quran.
Right, that the Quran is written in. So they don't know what's in the Quran. All they know about their religion is what the imam, the cleric, tells them. And so, you know, he tells them what they want them to know, but they really don't understand the fundamentals of their faith.
Right. And I want to say, unless you know enough about Muhammad and the Hadith, you can't understand the Quran. The Quran, to really be understood, has to be put in chronological order, which Muslims do not do. And then, in addition to that, it has to be infused with the context of the Hadith, which Muslims only want to do when it serves their interest. When you do those two things together, it's black and white. I mean, it is 99% of what's there, when it's put in context and in chronological order, 99% is either immoral or it is violent.
Would it be a fair statement to make, though, that there are many Muslims in the United States who really don't understand the religion they've embraced?
Well, of course. Now, worldwide, most Muslims are Muslims because they were born in a Muslim country, and that the penalty for rejecting Islam is death. Now, that's easy for us to say, but I want people to think about that for a moment. Any Muslim in any Islamic country who rejects his faith is murdered, and usually murdered by their own father.
No, well, that's not a very nice thing, but the truth of the matter is, if you convert to Christianity, why, of course, anybody can murder you and get away with it, and they will be honored for having, done something that they feel is good for their God is Allah.
That's
now,
correct.
This is certainly not what's done in Christianity. You can certainly leave the Christian faith if you want to. Your family may be very disappointed that you have. But I know
but they're not going to go kill you.
They're not going to go kill you, and that's the difference between the faiths, because their whole this good Muslim faith that you talk about is based upon violence. The bad is based upon doing good things and taking the trip to Mecca and praying five times a day. But even most of the Muslims don't even do that.
No, let me tell you that there's two things that are very important here. First, Islam is devoid of choice. It is a religion based on predestination, but more important than that, there is no choice. Anyone, they're told not to try to understand the Quran, not to question their faith, that Islam literally being a religion based upon submission and obedience, they're ordered to obey, there is no choice in Islam. Christianity is all about choice. You either choose to be with God or you choose not to be with God. No one can convert you to Christianity. Each individual makes their own choice. Now, the other point I want to make is that while there are many people who have corrupted, misinterpreted, if you will, taken out of context the Bible and used it to justify some heinous things, to do anything that is heinous, violent, terrorism, immoral, based upon the Bible, you have to take it out of context and corrupt it. The exact opposite is true with Islam. To make Islam sound decent and peaceful, you have to take it out of context and corrupt it. So it is exactly the opposite of Judeo-Christianity.
All right, our telephone number is 464-8295, or out across America, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295, or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Our guest is Craig Wynn. His book is Tea with Terrorists, and it's a fascinating, fascinating story. As Craig actually has tea with these terrorists, talks to them, and they admit to him readily that, of course, some of their funding is coming from the United States, others is coming from Saudi Arabia, our good allies, and of course, an entirely different perspective than you're getting from the controlled media here in the United States. And then he returns to this country, and then he begins to read and study. How long did it take you to really read and analyze and come to your conclusions on the fundamentals of Islam?
I have 7,000 hours in it, but even before I had the 7,000 hours in it, you really have to build a foundation, not only having traveled the world and understand the nature of similar kinds of doctrines. I mean, both Nazism and communism have a religious component, just like Islam has a very strong political component. And on top of that, you really need to know the Hebrew Bible, because the second half of the Quran, not as it's printed, but as it was revealed, is a wholly plagiarized version of the Hebrew Bible. And to understand that, you've got to know what things were changed and what the express purpose for the twisting was. And so it takes more than just the 7,000 hours of the Hadith and the Quran. And that's part of the reason I wrote the book. Tea with Terrorists is 600 pages, but in 10 hours you can really come to understand the nature of this doctrine and who these people are, why they kill, and what can be done to stop them. And I don't expect the average American to spend 7,000 hours studying it.
Well, you know, what can we do? Because, of course, we have, you know, there's certainly nothing more fundamental than a religious belief. And we have people who've really accepted these beliefs, the fact that if they die, you know, in jihad, that they're going to go to this this wonderful paradise with all sorts of sexual pleasures there. You know, religion is so fundamental to the individual. It's something you believe, you accept it as fact. And this is an all-consuming religion. How do you, and of course, one of the things in the Muslim faith is this intense fear of hell. And there's only one way that you can really be sure of getting into heaven, and that is, of course, to die in jihad. So how do you, can you possibly begin to change these people's perspective, their outlook, which is built upon a lie?
Yeah, truth is a powerful tool. If I can only get to the mainstream media outside of, I mean, there's a lot of heroes and courageous people like yourself in talk radio, but there are no heroes in the television media. They're all cowards, and our politicians are cowards. If we could get somebody in politics and the mainstream television media to dedicate enough time to become expert on this, we could change the world, because it is so obvious that Allah is not a god. Let me give you two great examples that you hinted at in your introduction here. One is that the single most repeated theme in the Quran is pain and punishment, devils and hell. Allah is personally shown shackling men, deceiving them, dragging them into hell, putting them on a spit, rotating them over fire, using their bodies as he says, for the faggots of hell's fires, boiling water down their throats, all for his entertainment. Now, there is no chance in the world that there is a deity that is in hell tormenting men. None. But the second thing is, look at the other side, at the perversity of Allah's depiction of paradise. It's multiple versions, all there to satiate the carnal desires of murderers. The rivers flow with wine. How is it that anyone can think a book can be holy when it prohibits you being involved in drinking and fornication on earth, yet the reward for murder is fornication and drinking?
That really is. I've never heard of it expressed quite that way, but that certainly is a paradox. That is a contradiction.
Oh, the Quran is just literally full of contradictions. So the Quran, Surah 2106, which is the break point in the Quran. That's the point where you've left the 80 surahs of Mecca, which are just hateful drivel, and you move into the piracy and the political nature of Islam in Medina, which was at the time Yathrib. 2106 says that it's called the abrogation verse. It says whenever we cancel a verse or throw it into oblivion, we bring one which is better, which means that every surah that was in these first 80 surahs that says something that is not warlike, for example, it would be abrogated or cast into oblivion because of the 34 remaining surahs. They're almost exclusively about war and piracy and booty and thievery and assassinations and the slave trade. And, you know, it's revolting. And
Could you explain, what is a surah? Is this a story? Is this a...
No, the Quran is broken into 114 what are called surahs. They're, I guess you would call them chapters. They're some, like the second surah is extremely long. It's in the range of 45 to 50 pages, and yet there are many surahs that are as short as a quarter of a page. And the Quran is ordered longest surah to shortest surah, which is about the opposite way they were actually revealed. The 96th surah, for example, of the 114 was the first allegedly handed down, and the last one handed down was the fifth surah. Now, what's interesting about the 96th is that when you give it the context of the hadith, what you find is that Muhammad knew that he had met in his first meeting with the devil. He tried to commit suicide. He wrestled with a demon in a cave. He ran to his wife absolutely out of his mind, screaming, yelling, saying, I have encountered a demon, and I fear for my life.
That is indeed a frightening story. Does the average Muslim have any idea that this really is a demonic religion?
No, I don't think so. You know, the Satan plays a starring role in the Quran, and the reason Satan and hell and punishment play such a starring role in the Quran is it's all about fear. You know, if you scare people to death, they will obey you. And there are so many evidences for it being satanic. You know, the book Salman Rushdie wrote, The Satanic Verses, that's a true event in Muhammad's life. The story is unbelievable, but it's their story, and it's in their scriptures. What happened is the Quraysh, which was Muhammad's tribe in Mecca, offered the Prophet a bargain because he was a nuisance. He was condemning them. He was destroying their traditional values. He was just your typical nuisance. And so they offered him the three things that he wanted most if he would accept two of the pagan deities that were in their Kaaba, which was a pagan shrine. That's the thing they all bow down to. They go to their Hajj. Well, it was a pagan shrine long before it became the symbol of Islam. And that you would think that the thing they would have to offer this great prophet, this man of Allah, would be to accept his prophethood, that maybe acknowledge his God Allah, something like that, right? Acknowledge that the Quran is really from God as opposed to plagiarized drivel. No. They offered him the three things he really wanted. They offered him the prettiest women in Mecca, sex. They offered him a founder's share of the Kaaba religious scam, money. They offered him power, the three things he coveted. And you know something? The next hadith in Tabari, chronologically, is the Satanic Verses, where Muhammad waltz up to the Kaaba and says that Alat and Al-Uzza, throws in Manat, who's the goddess of the crescent moon and the goddess of fatalism, that all three of these stone idols, these pagan gods, are intermediaries to Allah. Now, his handful of followers have a conniption fit. They say, wait a minute, you know, you lured us into this thing calling it a monotheistic religion, and four deities is at least three too many for a monotheistic religion. And so Muhammad says, oh, not to worry, Satan put those words into my mouth, and Allah will abrogate what Satan has revealed. And that's how we have the Satanic Verses. It follows on the heels of the Quraysh bargain, where this prophet was bought off by sex, money, and power.
Well, you know, that's really very interesting, because, of course, after Salman Rushdie wrote that, of course, a contract was put out on his life. And really, all he was doing was writing what's in the Quran and the Hadith.
And it's both places.
And and yet, of course, now there's a contract. The Ayatollah Khomeini put a contract out in his life. Why would they do that? Because I don't think they want the average Muslim to read the Satanic Verse and then understand the basis of their religion.
That is correct. What he wrote was absolutely true. See, particularly in America and in Europe, Muslims are confronted with something that Islam has never had to deal with in all of its 14-year history, which is freedom. And it cannot handle freedom. It hates being exposed. Some of the radio stations that I have spoken on, Muslims will have protests. And even when these radio stations will give equal time to the Islamic cleric and have the two of us debate, they'll still protest. And the reason they'll protest is not because I've misquoted their scriptures, but I quote them accurately. It's because they can't handle it being exposed. That if Islam is exposed for what it really is, it dies. And when it dies, all of the clerics and all of the dictators that rely on it lose their positions of power and wealth.
And I think that it's so important for our listeners to understand that in this faith, why religion and government are one and the same. And, of course, the ultimate goal, if they possibly can, is to have a society that's run by the clerics and where everybody has to abide by the law, where women have no rights, where crime is punished by beheading and cutting off hands and feet and various and sundry things, and by stoning. They still stone and people to death in this archaic religion. And yet, of course, this is one of the most powerful religions in the world today.
it's powerful because it's a political doctrine, and because it is totalitarian. Totalitarian, 100% of it's totalitarian.
We'll be right back here.
It can be evil.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and of course our guest this evening is Craig Wynn, and he's written a book called Tea with Terrorists. And Craig, the music there was sort of swelling up, but would you repeat what you said, because it is really so fundamental to this whole discussion of what this religion is really all about. As the religion and the government become one, why don't you just repeat that
thought? Islam is far more political doctrine than it is a religion, and because of the way it is presented in the Hadith and the Quran, it is always totalitarian. And so totalitarian political doctrines like Nazism and communism concentrate power amongst typically evil men who use it viciously. And so long as a political doctrine that concentrates power based upon deceit and violence exists, the world will be in terrible peril. So long as the Soviet Union was communist, there were wars fought around the world where millions of people died. When Germany had that same form of government, 55 million people died as a result. Imperial Japan was exactly the same thing. These kinds of doctrines cannot exist in a civilized world. Islam, fundamental Islam, is far worse than Nazism ever was. It's far worse than communism. It cannot exist in a peaceful world.
And I think that this is really the essence of what you're saying. But then, how can we then, as people in a free society, counter this? Certainly, here in the United States, we acknowledge that the Muslims have the right to preach their faith. And, of course, they intend to win and take over America simply by being here and by multiplying and gaining political influence and power. Once they have political influence and power, of course, they will cease to be tolerant of other religions. Right now, they talk about our Constitution and their rights to practice a religion. But ultimately, when the Muslims are in power, they tolerate no other religion, contrary to the way we look at things. So, we have within our own society the cancer, the makings of the ultimate destruction of the very society that is allowing the Muslims to flourish here. How can we approach this thing without being destroying everything we believe in ourselves?
Well, the first thing we have to do is understand the nature of the doctrine. We as a people do not have to tolerate doctrines that cause people to be violent and kill. You know, the Ku Klux Klan was a great example of a disgusting doctrine that caused people to commit terrible acts of violence and racism. And in the 1920s, the Ku Klux Klan, I think, was 4 million people in America. But then something happened in the late 1920s. The media started to expose it. There were some scandals related to the Klan. And as soon as the media began to expose it, it became a terrible stain to be part of such a stupid, disgusting, revolting organization. And so what happened as a result is that within 2 years, the Klan went from 4 million people down to in the range of a couple of 100,000 people. The same thing can happen in Islam. We need to expose it for what it is. We need the majority of Americans to be aware of it. And so that to be a Muslim is such a stigma that if you're a Muslim, it's like saying that I'm a Nazi. You know, if you were to go out and say I'm a Nazi, everyone would look at you and say, what kind of a nut are you? I mean, they would look at you with disgust. They'd say that, you know, you obviously have no intellect, you have no ability to reason, you're a hateful, violent person. And that's why, while there are some Nazis in America, there are very few. And the same thing would be true if we were to expose Islam effectively. There would be such a stigma associated with it that there would be very few American Muslims, very few Muslims in any free country for that regard.
Yes,
one of the things you said, though, is very true, Stan. I just want to make one point, is that in all of Europe right now, the fundamental Muslims are now in the range of anywhere from 10 to 25% of the population of some of these countries like France, Great Britain, and Germany. And they're attempting to do the same thing in America. And if we don't do something quickly, it'll be too late, and we will lose our freedoms.
Well, I agree with you totally, and I think that there's a real problem there. But as you pointed out earlier, if anybody within the government or within the intelligence agencies talks about the very real danger of Islam, they're going to be relieved of their job and may very well come under tremendous pressure and scrutiny. So, you know, if people don't have the right to express, as you would do and I do, the truth, why we're going to continue blundering along the same path and attacking the wrong enemy.
Well, that's true, but we get the government we deserve, Stan. And because average Americans are ignorant, we get a government that deceives us, and they deceive us for their own selfish interests. And so we can stop this nonsense by shedding our ignorance. If we as a nation shed our ignorance, if enough people, it doesn't take that many people, surprisingly, it doesn't take that many good people to stand up and make a difference and change everything. And hopefully that will occur, because if it occurs, America has a bright future. If it doesn't occur, if we stay in our soundbite mentality, if we continue to be manipulated because of our ignorance, then America's future is very bleak indeed, and we have a very short history in front of us.
Well, I think the most important thing to do would be to get to the leaders of the conservative Christian movement and let them really understand what the issues are and what has to be done, because this is not only an ideological battle, it is a spiritual battle as well, between two entirely different spiritual ideologies.
I've only found one of the well-known leaders of the Christian right, if you will, that has the courage to deal with Islam. 100% of the others, and I know many of them personally, won't touch it with a 10-foot pole. They're afraid of it. They're not willing to risk their religious standing by dealing with it. And many of them know the truth. But the one is Pat Robertson. Pat Robertson, God bless him, has got the courage of 1,000 men. And the intellect of 1,000 men as well. He's willing to do it. The rest are not. They don't have the courage.
Well, I certainly applaud Pat for taking a strong stand on this, because it is so vitally important. And, of course, he does have an outreach to the Christian Broadcasting Network, to CBN, to reach the public. And this is the thing. How do you reach the public when most of the mainline media certainly are controlled by I refer to as the establishment, and then of course your major thrust has to be by alternative radio, and I know you are doing a tremendous amount of radio interviews. I know you're a gentleman who's scheduling it to be on these programs, and this is so vitally necessary. The interesting thing is that an awful lot of people listen now, either shortwave, internet, or to the various stations that carry the alternative radio programs. Do you think that if your book is moving as rapidly as you say, in other words, you can't keep it in print, obviously you're reaching an awful lot of people with your message?
Oh, yes. Yesterday, for example, I spent 10 hours on live talk radio. I do anywhere from 5 to 7 interviews a day. Very often I'll start before 8 o'clock in the morning on radio shows on the East Coast and finish on the West Coast late at night. But, I'm just one guy. You're just one guy. We need more soldiers in this struggle. This is a war of ideas, one book and a few courageous speakers is just not enough to save America. You know, when I accepted this mission, and I view it as a mission. I work for Yahweh. He's the God of the Old Testament. It's why I go off and do this. I was hoping, Dr. Stan, that this was a Jonah mission. You know, Jonah was sent to Nineveh, which was Assyria, which is today's Iraq. They were the baddest boys on the planet at the time. They were the terrorists. And he delivered a similar message to them, and they stopped separating themselves from Yahweh, and they survived another 100 years. And I was hoping that that could be part of this this mission, that America would take notice and heed and stop separating itself from God and stop accepting and tolerating false doctrines that are killing us. Unfortunately, I don't believe that's the case. I believe that America is not going to wake up. That doesn't stop my zeal and my passion for trying, but I don't think we are going to wake up. I think we're headed for a train wreck, and so the majority of my mission is to try to get people off the train, to have them recognize there is a God who loves them and wants to form a personal relationship with them. His name is Yahweh. His son's name was Yahshua, which means I am saves. And we need to know him before this train crashes.
Amen to that. Well, this is why I do what I do 5 hours a day and then on Saturdays as well. But right now we've got David calling in from Corona down south. Hi, David. How are you doing?
Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for the program today. Yeah, I just wanted to mention there's somebody else here in the Southern California area that is standing up against Islam. And we can't forget Dr. Robert Murray, author of The Islamic Invasion.
Yes, we've had Dr. Murray on our programs many times. He does a great job.
He does. He's a well-educated man, and he's been speaking out against fundamental Islam for quite some time.
And in fact, they've threatened him on a number of occasions, threatened his life for doing what he does.
Yep.
Anything else, David?
Oh, that's about it. Yeah, he's got his radio program down here in Southern California.
And we certainly applaud him for what he does. And in fact, he was recently taken off the major station he was on. Did he get onto another station? Because they contacted me for ideas about where he ought to be going, and I gave them several suggestions. Has he moved to another station?
Oh, yeah. He's on a secular station, Hot Talk, KPLF 830, and he's got a strong signal now. And I tell you, he's... getting a lot of people upset, but praise God, the gospel is going out, and Islam is being exposed for what it is.
Amen to that. Well, thank you, sir, very much.
Okay, good night.
Bye-bye, David. And, of course, that was David calling in from Corona, California. And if you're out there, you have a question or comment here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295, and then certainly out across the entire country where we're being heard by the miracle of the Internet, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Our guest is Craig Wynn, his book, Tea with Terrorists, and you can get that from Barnes & Noble, from Amazon.com. In fact, you really got some tremendous response off of Amazon.com, haven't you?
Yeah, in fact, not too long ago, back when we were a couple of weeks ago, when we had a reasonable amount of inventory, we're about ready to replenish the supply channel again, but we were the number three book at Amazon. And for a book this controversial, particularly for a book that's 600 pages, that's pretty remarkable. So we're getting the message out. For those that don't know, there really are two different messages in Tea with Terrorists. One of those messages is what we've been talking about. It exposes specifically who the terrorists are, why they kill, and what can be done to stop them. But the second message of Tea with Terrorists was written for agnostics and for my Jewish friends. I wanted them to come to know the Messiah. And so there is a very strong gospel presentation in Tea with Terrorists, one that is more intellectual. It goes over the proofs that Yahshua was the Messiah and that Yahweh is God, using prophecy. And another walks the reader through the last 24 hours of Christ's life and the places that he lived them. And it's a very powerful, very moving part of the book.
Well, you know, I really believe that America is approaching extremely difficult times, but I think it's really going to take something like that to get people out of their complacency. We've got a lot of Christians, you know, who are so heavenly minded, they're no earthly good, and they are simply so involved, you know, with the Christianity that they don't see what's happening in our society, and really they are not having anything in the way of fruit other than creating a lot of other people who have sort of a warm, mushy religion. But I believe that as we enter into difficult times, this is going to separate the sheep from the goats, and either the people are going to have really total belief, in their Savior. and become increasingly reliant upon him rather than relying on themselves, and of course hope for deliverance and from the help of the difficult times, or they're going to fall by the wayside. Because, but this is what you need. That we saw that time and time again in the Old Testament, the children of Israel would turn against God, turn against their God, and of course then God would bring judgment upon them, and he would actually bring in the Assyrians or the Egyptians or some other country and totally destroy them and enslave them, and then of course only in the bad times did people really want to turn back to God. And I just have a feeling as I see this whole scenario unfolding before us that that's exactly where we're headed today.
Well, I hope that we get a lot of passionate, bold people, because this is a time to be passionate and bold, and it is a time to be intolerant of any false doctrine. You know, one of the things that that peeves me so much is that we have done such a bad job of translating the Hebrew Bible and the Greek New Testament into English. Let me share with you one of the mistranslations that ought to motivate Christians, motivate Jews as well. Before I do that, let me say one other thing, which is that the God of the Old Testament has a name. His name is Yahweh. He gave it to us 6,868 times in the Old Testament, and we edited his name out of the Old Testament. His name means I am, and it's the answer to the single most important question that a human being can ask. Now, the third commandment, which most every Bible says, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, there is no chance that the creator of the universe etched those words in stone. First of all, he didn't etch them in English, he etched them in Hebrew. And in Hebrew, it does not say that, because a name cannot be taken in vain is either egotistical or a failed enterprise. What he actually said is, thou shalt not accept nor advance in the name of Yahweh, your deity, anything that is false or destructive. That's what it says when it's translated directly out of the Hebrew. Thou shalt not accept or advance in the name or character of Yahweh, your deity, anything that is false or destructive. It is an order for us to go out and be bold, exposing false doctrines like Islam.
Well, I agree with you totally, and I think that this is something, especially now, as we increasingly hear about the threat of Islamic terrorism here in the United States, as our boys, of course, are engaged in a war in the Middle East, and, of course, their opponents there, probably most of them are bad Muslims. I'm sure there are, by your vernacular, there are a few good Muslims there within Iraq. And for our listeners, you have to understand the good Muslim is the one who really wants to destroy the infidels. The bad Muslim is the one who is a nominal Muslim, but he has no antagonism necessarily towards the Christian or the Jew. The good Muslim does. He hates them, and he will destroy them if he has the opportunity.
And that's why, Dr. Stan, there are so many people surrendering right now in Iraq, is that 75% of Muslims are bad Muslims, which means they could be good, peaceful people just trying to survive and raise their families. Unfortunately, our troops are not, when they move into Baghdad, are not going to know a good Muslim from a bad Muslim, and a good Muslim is going to want to kill him. And the bad Muslim, of course, is going to want to surrender and be able to live a life freed of tyranny. And that's the same problem we had, of course, in Vietnam. We couldn't tell the communist from the non-communist. And the more bombs we dropped, the more communists we manufactured.
Well, I just hope and pray that some of the level heads there, will do away with Saddam and, of course, surrender and put an end to this, because otherwise it's going to be a lot of useless slaughter, not only of our boys, but, of course, of the Muslim soldiers, or I should say the Iraqi soldiers and the Iraqi civilians. This is what really concerns me.
Yeah, one of my problems is, of course, is the occupation force that goes even afterwards. First of all, this whole war is going to be, it's either going to be costly or not costly, depending on what happens when we go into the 12 cities. We go in the 12 cities, if we don't confront nuclear biological weapons, if we don't have fundamentalist Muslims try to commit martyrdom and make their way to Allah's brothel by killing us, then we still are confronted with trying to have an occupation force and to establish a Western-style government in a region that in 1,400 years has never had an open society.
Well, I think the idea that we're going to establish a democracy there, or the fact that our boys are going to come home just as soon as the hostilities are over and they're no longer needed, I think is totally ridiculous. First of all, that we're planning on leaving a permanent occupation force there of at least 100 and perhaps several hundred thousand men. And secondly, I agree with you totally, a democracy doesn't work. Why do we want to institute a democracy over there when, of course, the path to freedom is not through democracy, it is through a republican form of government and a limited government. Democracy, as Plato said, writing in the Republic over 2,350 years ago, democracies always degenerate into despotism.
Well, and the reality is that America cannot afford to have 50,000, much less 200,000 troops there as an occupation force in that country. There is no way out of what we are now into, and that alarms me, particularly when I recognize the quality of the men and women, the sons and daughters that are over there fighting. It just tears out my heart because these are wonderful, disciplined, courageous, intelligent, well-trained men, and I believe they're just being used wrongly.
Well, I do too. Let's go to Jerry calling in from Jerry in Capitola. Hi, Jerry. How are you?
Hey, how's it going? Good. I have a question about the Bible translations you guys were just talking about earlier. This concerns me greatly, and I was wondering what books, or maybe you should write a book or do a book on it about translating the Bible and those, you know, just minor little word shifts that go on in translation. Where can I look, maybe on the internet, or what books would you recommend to kind of study that subject?
What I do is at any time that I'm writing about something and I want to make sure I have it right, is I go to Concordance and I translate the passage out of Concordance. But when you study, there are several books on the history of Bible translations, and when you read them, it'll make your skin crawl as to, you know, why the King James Version, for example, came into existence, which was politically, entirely politically motivated, and how the translation was made from a translation of a translation of a translation. We have serious problems in this regard, and I guess the two things I would recommend for you is that you can go to a Christian bookstore and buy versions of the Bible that will take, say, four different translations. I have several of them. Take four translations and run them in parallel all the way through. And when you do that, you're going to get closer to the true meaning. And if you combine that with a concordance, I think the two together work beautifully. What you'll find, if you take the time to use the concordance and translate it out of either Greek or Hebrew,
mm-hmm.
is that God's word is infinitely more powerful. Actually communicated it than it is translated into English.
This is what I find when you say "I am." I mean, these are real fundamental things, and you don't want them to get lost in the translation. I mean, it's a tragedy. I don't know.
God's name is the single most profound thing in all of the Bible, because what it tells you is that he wants to have a personal relationship with us. He gave us his name because you can't have a personal relationship without knowing somebody's name.
Right.
And not only did he give it to us 6,868 times, and we translated them all out, but the power of what is the meaning behind that name. The name means I am. Not only does that tell you that God exists, therefore everything changes in terms of our life and our perspective, but more important than that, it gives you the number one element that, in my view, separates us from God. Because we are by being different from God, in that, you know, we're created in God's image. So God's a lot more like us than most Christian pastors will want to admit, and we're a lot more like God. We have godly characteristics. But the principal thing is God lives outside of time. Mm. He can maneuver in time, which means that's how he knows what's going to happen in the tribulation, is because he exists outside of time. That's why he chose the name I Am.
I guess.
I think it's really so interesting when you commented on that. I remember, of course, the story of a Jesus, and he's surrounded. I think he's in the synagogue, and some of the elders asked him, well, who are you? And he said, I am. And, of course, he has said, I am. They understand what that means. He is God.
He's saying that, yeah, because God's name is I am.
Right. And, of course, then they're just furious. They want to stone him because nobody says, I am. And, of course, he does a beautiful job, of course, countering that and leaves. It goes to the crowd. But, you know, the significance of that, that at that point in his ministry, he was the first time he actually came forward and saying, I am God. And that's a pretty powerful statement. And yet, of course, if you read the rest of the gospel, you begin to realize that this indeed was the truth, that he was the Lamb of God come as sacrifice for the sins of mankind.
Hey, do you have any other translation?
His name being Yeshua is as important as us knowing that God's name, by the way, God is not a name, it's a word, that God's name is Yahweh. The fact that Christ's name was Yeshua, not Jesus. Jesus is the name of a horned deity. It's a demonic deity of the Druid religion. But Yeshua, because Yeshua means Yah, means I am. It's the short for I am Yah. Shua is short for salvation, so it means I am saved. So when the angel Gabriel came to Mary and said, you shall name him, she didn't say you're going to name him Jesus. She said, you shall name him Yeshua, I am saved.
Okay, anything else, Jerry? Oh, we lost Jerry. Well, we're just about out of time. Look, I want to thank you so very much for being with us, and especially for 2 hours of your time, and I know how valuable it is. But I just wanted my listeners to get the full story, and the other previous interviews, it's pretty hard to do in simply an hour. So there's so much to cover, and we haven't covered it all yet, but it's been fascinating. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners this evening?
No, but I want to tell you that I am so pleased that you've allowed this discussion to move towards Yahweh and Yeshua and our relationship as a nation and individually with the Creator of the universe, because that is where the solution to all of this is, and I don't very often get that opportunity, and I'm very grateful that you've allowed that.
Well, of course, that, of course, is what we always try to get to at the end of our program. Sometimes there's just so much to cover, we don't, but we always try to leave our listeners with that, because the hope is not in what I say, the hope is not in politics, the hope is not in electing a Democrat or Republican.
Right.
The hope is in our Savior.
Yeah, and not separating ourselves as a nation and individuals from Yahweh Yeshua. One of the things that we've talked about is being bold and passionate in our faith, and the source of the boldness and the passion is directly from God Himself, and that's where we will find the answer. That's where we'll find the solution and the power and the passion to turn our country around if we're going to do it.
God bless you. Thank you so very much for being with us, Craig.
Dr. Stan, it's always a pleasure.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, I guess this evening has been Craig Wynn, and I hope you've enjoyed the program. And it's been 2 hours, and I apologize for a few little mechanical difficulties at the beginning, but hopefully we're going to have our board replaced here just very, very shortly. But anyway, it's just fortunate we were able to do the program this evening. This is the time we ask you to pray for America, because we're involved in the spirits about it. We ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers. We ask you to pray for our boys over there in harm's way. We ask you to pray for the Arab civilians, and pray that, of course, the battle does not spread over into Israel. And lastly, we ask you to remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until Monday, when we'll be back with you, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.
That's a good program.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming up tonight.
Mm-hmm. Wait, I got some more collage done on the Phillips. That worked out.
But anyway, no, he's a fascinating kind of thing, guy.
He actually
is. Yeah. He actually has been on the front page of Time magazine, you know, and one of the really leading entrepreneurs.
He
thinks very, very clearly.
Mm-hmm. He does. He takes his point. He gets to the point, and anything. Oh. Yeah. Well, you got a lot done tonight, probably.
Yeah. Just nice. It's like when I bring something out to work on, and the people start calling. I'm kind of like, don't do that.